Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Glyn Blackett, who is a mind-body health coach from York in the UK. He specialises in stress management skills training, in particular with the use of biofeedback in conjunction with the practice of mindfulness. He's the author of the book Mind-Body Intelligence, How to Manage Your Mind Using Biofeedback and Mindfulness, and this will be the topic of our discussion today. Hello, Glyn. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, could you begin, Glyn, by telling us something, a little bit about yourself and, you know, how you got involved in this field of work?
Okay, so, yeah, let me start by saying a little bit about what I do right now, which is I work with clients who have generally some form of stress-related problems. So I help with stress and anxiety, especially. How did I get into that? Well, I suppose the key thing I'm doing is this biofeedback. That's what sort of differentiates me. And the story of my involvement with biofeedback goes probably right back to my university days, which is well over 20 years ago now. So at that time, that was the time when I first came across meditation.
Yeah.
So I read a book about meditation and Buddhism and was very much attracted by the idea of this, let's call it enlightenment, without going too far into it. So I learned to meditate, cut a long story short, and quite quickly realized that I was really not very good at it, in the sense that I struggled to concentrate. I was distracted for a large majority of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah? And moreover, the longer it went on, as the years went by, I seemed to get worse. Perhaps because my sort of expectations and my interest sort of waned. I think what I found was that I wasn't really enjoying it.
Yeah.
It became a bit of a chore. And I kept with it out of sheer doggedness, but I wasn't benefiting and I wasn't even enjoying it. So I realized I had to do something different. So I started to think about what could possibly help. And my training, my education was in science.
Yeah.
So I started to think, well, how can science help? How can technology help? And again, to cut a long story short, I ended up reading a book in which I came across the idea of biofeedback. And I thought, aha, this is exactly what I'm looking for. It just sounded like the real deal. Not only that, but it's well, from there I started to acquire my first biofeedback devices and I learned how to work with it. And I just got more and more into it. And then I started to think, well, I'm so into this that I could make a career of it. Because at that time I didn't really have a vocation. And I was looking for something to sort of give my life to, and it became biofeedback.
Yeah. And has it been a good move?
It certainly has. You know, it's helped my meditation practice. You know, I consistently, even now, I still use biofeedback in my personal meditation practice, more or less on a daily basis. And I still find that if I don't use it, I still predominantly am distracted. My mind is thinking about, it's planning what I'm going to do later on. My mind is just scattered.
Yeah.
Yeah. But with biofeedback, at least I'm engaging. It's not that it suddenly becomes easy, but at least I'm kind of there most of the time and I'm engaging. And moreover, I find meditation now gratifying. I enjoy doing the practice because I'm more effective.
Yeah.
You know, I'm more effective in accessing the sort of states of mind that I want to access, which is, you know, the reason that I'm doing the meditation.
Yeah. And I don't think you're alone there as well. I think this resonates a lot with my own experience with meditation. I do feel the benefits of it, but sometimes I feel, you know, I've been meditating for about 5 years, and although I find it helpful, and I'm often in a better mind state at the end of the meditation practice than at the beginning, I can't honestly say in the 5 years' time whether I'm less distracted in a particular session on average than I was 5 years ago. And so
yeah.
I'm very intrigued by this idea of biofeedback. But you you actually entitle your book, the main title is Mind-Body Intelligence. So maybe we should just start with that. What do you mean by that? What is mind-body intelligence?
Okay, well, I'll just explain that with reference to what I do with biofeedback. So I'm working with problems like stress and anxiety. And my view of those problems is that they're very much mind-body phenomena, which is to say that they're not just in the mind, they're not just in the thinking, but they're also, if you like, there's a physiology of anxiety, of stress.
Yeah.
And not only that, but there's a physiology of the positive counterparts, like calm, relaxed, focused, emotionally positive. There's a different physiology for those positive states. Yeah. So my strategy for working as a therapist and coach is to teach people to guide their own physiology from the more negative forms, you know, from the physiology of anxiety and stress towards this different physiology that supports positivity. Yeah. So mind-body intelligence is a phrase that I use to mean the skill of being able to make that transition, to be able to guide your own physiology, you know, from a negative and unproductive state towards something that just works better and makes it easier to access the sort of states of mind that you want to access.
Okay, and so when you say guiding, are you talking about having better self-control to an extent, or regulation?
Yes, in a way, yes. I think it is about self-control. I think that's a good way of putting it. I think it's a certain kind of self-control. It's perhaps not self-control in the sense of willpower, or perhaps what people might normally understand by self-control. But it's more like the self-control of, if I can give an example of, let's say, a tennis player who's playing tennis and playing tennis well, and he's in control. He's in control of his game, and he's performing pretty well. Yeah. Now, you could say that that's a kind of self-control. You know, he's in control of his body and mind as well. But I think it's, with that example, again, it's not just the willpower thing. There's something of a sense that the tennis player just lets their body do it for them.
Yeah, I think the term's in the zone in tennis, isn't it?
Yeah, they do use that kind of phrase, being in the zone, or another sort of equivalent phrase is being in a state of flow.
Okay, so what would you say are the main challenges to self-control, Gillian?
Well, I think, again, you know, referring to the kind of problems that I work with, stress and anxiety, I see the main problems as inappropriate efforts to control, if you like. I mean, anxiety, stress, we all experience it. They are problems. They're not diseases. And it's not like you can ever get to a point where you're never going to experience anxiety. So everybody is going to have some anxiety in life. Yeah. But if your attitude towards anxiety is that it's bad for you, it's harmful, or, you know, stress generally, if you think that you've got to avoid it at all costs because it's going to impair your health and your performance, yeah, then it's going to work against you. It's actually going to make things worse.
Yeah. So this brings to mind arguably the difference between repression and suppression. It's certainly my experience. If I try to repress things, then it will reappear, or something else will reappear in another form. Whereas in life in general, suppression is, we're constantly suppressing things. Like, for example, you know, you might be given a talk, you might need to go to the toilet. In order to perform that talk, you somehow manage, in a very embodied way, to repress that need to go to the loo, if you see what I mean. Whereas repression seems more this quicksand effect you're talking about. To what extent would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think suppression can work. I mean, it just essentially means just pushing things out of your mind.
Yeah.
I think it can work as long as the thing that you're pushing out doesn't have an awful lot of emotional charge behind it. Because what you've got to bear in mind is that you've got a fairly limited kind of fuel supply or energy supply for doing suppression. You know, if you have to keep on doing it, the mind will get fatigued. And your suppression will break down.
Sure.
Yeah. And not only that, but if there's an emotional force behind the thing that you're trying to push away, yeah, it's just going to keep coming back, and it's just going to keep coming back with more energy and perhaps in other ways. So yes, the quicksand trap is a metaphor for any kind of situation where you're trying to suppress or get rid of something. You're trying hard, but it's not working, and it's even making things worse. So in quicksand, you struggle and you go down. If you don't struggle, you just basically float. So quicksand in the mind is when you're just trying to push something out of your mind, and it's coming back all the more strongly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah? So would you say with things like anxiety, anger, craving, concentration issues and depression, the quicksand effect is very much in play here?
Yes, I think it is. These are things that are problems in the mind. You know, they're all kind of mental experiences, mental and emotional experiences. And naturally, we don't want to experience. We'd rather not experience them. Yeah. So we sort of push them away. They tend to come back all the more strongly.
And then going back to this idea of control, and you gave the analogy of the tennis player. Could you just go into a bit more detail what flow is? You mentioned this, the notion of flow.
Right, yeah, flow. So flow is a kind of experience where you just become deeply absorbed in it. Like, for example, a tennis player who's right in the zone, or an artist doing a picture, or a musician playing some music. And the experience is one of absorption. You get so into it, whatever it is that you're doing, that you sort of forget yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah? You forget that you're doing it. So you lose the sense of what you might call self-consciousness. It's also characterized by a feeling of effortlessness. So you're there and you're doing this thing, and it's taking up all of you, all of your awareness, all of your attention, and it becomes easy. So you don't have any sense that you're trying hard.
Okay. And
you're just flowing.
And this is the state of mind or state of body mind that we should be aspiring to.
Well, yeah, I think so. I think that the thing about it, it's very enjoyable. Or at least what happens is that we look back and we think, oh, yes, I enjoyed that.
Yeah.
Now, it can be anything, actually. It can even be work. You know, you might work as, I don't know, a telephone receptionist. And you can spend all day answering the phone and answering people's questions, and you can get so absorbed that you're just into it, and that can be a flow state.
Yeah.
So it doesn't have to be, you know, earth-shatteringly pleasurable. In fact, it doesn't even have to be pleasurable at all, but you just have to be engaged to the point that it becomes easy and you sort of forget yourself and that you're having to do it, as it were.
Okay.
So it doesn't have to be any pleasure or even positive emotion there. But being in flow and regularly accessing flow is an important component of general well-being.
Yeah, but do we also have to be careful sometimes of not seeing the bigger, you know, idealizing or not seeing the bigger picture in flow states too? I'm thinking, for example, a parent may be upstairs in their studio creating a great piece of art, while their kids are downstairs and they're not getting fed, they're not getting their evening meal. I personally can get in that sort of mindset sometimes. I'm very good at flowing some, but I sometimes neglect other responsibilities, like, you know, doing the dishes and things like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is a danger, and there is even, you know, because flow, you know, you can get into flow doing almost anything, even some things that are quite negative in an ethical respect. So for example, things that you can get addicted to, you know, almost, you know, flow states are addictive.
Yeah.
So something like, say, gambling. Perhaps, you know, I've never really done it, but arguably you could get into a flow state by spending a night in the casino. It's not necessarily a good idea. It's not necessarily a good thing to do. So, yeah, you've got to be careful about, you know, your choice of activities. And it's not like you're going to be in flow all the time.
Now, you talk in the book, Glyn, about what you suggest that we have, in a sense, dual intelligences.
Okay, yeah. In the book, I talk about, I have a model of two kinds of intelligence. By intelligence, I mean a way of understanding and knowing about things, but also of doing things. So I make this kind of split, and I say that one intelligence, I call it the thinking intelligence, which is a lot to do with willpower and thinking and problem solving, and also the conscious mind. And the other one is, I call it body intelligence. So the idea is that the body has its own way of knowing and doing. So if we talk about, say, food, for example, yeah, the thinking mind might know that sugar's bad for you and vegetables are good for you, things like that. But the body knows when you're hungry, and it knows when you've just eaten enough that it's time to stop eating. So the basic idea is that the body does some things much better than the thinking mind. And moreover, we can get into trouble, you know, for example, the quicksand trap that I mentioned. The quicksand we can see is when one part of you, or this thinking intelligence, is trying to do something that is best left to the other, the body intelligence. So, for example, we talked about playing tennis earlier on. Sometimes when things aren't going very well in tennis, you can sort of try too hard. And the thinking mind is going, come on, get your footwork right, or make sure your grip is right. And if you sort of over-focus on those things, you can turn it all to pot, because it's really the body that knows how to play tennis. And getting into the zone for tennis is like getting the body to do it. So it's in terms of the model, the dual intelligence model, it's how does the thinking mind sort of let go and at the same time access the resourcefulness of the body intelligence without using willpower. And that's the challenge of working with stress and anxiety as well, because emotions are very much in that category. They're very, very much connected to body intelligence. They're something that, you know, anxiety, for example, it happens in the body, or at least in part in the body. So you got to work with the body. So, but how do you get the body to relax? Well, the body already knows how to relax, but it's not necessarily going to relax by willpower. So how do you access that resourcefulness at the level of the body? That's the challenge.
Okay. And what do you understand by the term integration in relation to all this? What are its key features?
Okay. Integration. Well, perhaps I can explain it a bit better by talking about what's not integration, what the state of unintegration is. So it's when different parts of the mind are sort of pulling in different directions, yeah, and especially at different times. So an example of disintegration, if you like, might be, let's say that you want to give up smoking, yeah. So you decide you're not, like, from tomorrow I'm not going to smoke anymore. Or perhaps another example might be that from tomorrow I'm going to meditate every day, every morning, yeah. And then when tomorrow comes, you feel differently, yeah. You wake up in the morning, the alarm goes off, and you think, oh, to hell with that, you know, I can't be bothered getting out of bed to meditate. Or you think, oh, I just want that cigarette. So your resolution from before is gone. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you could put that in terms of there's one part of you that wants to meditate or wants to stop smoking, and another part of you that wants to carry on as normal. And they're kind of disconnected. Yeah. They're not integrated. Yeah.
Okay, Glenn, so what's the core of your approach then to help people train the mind?
Okay, well, if I can take it back to the idea of the mind-body connection, which is that there's a problem physiology and a solution physiology. And the strategy overall is to teach people these skills, what I call mind-body skills or mind-body intelligence, which is guiding the physiological state from the negative state to the positive state. And the one key tool that I use to help people learn these skills is biofeedback. So yeah, biofeedback is a tool that facilitates learning.
Yeah.
It's not a treatment or anything like that. It doesn't do anything to you, but it's a tool for learning. So in biofeedback, you measure aspects of physiology that in some sense correlate with the sort of states that we talk about, both the problem states like anxiety and the solution states like calm, focus, positivity. So to give a simple example that everyone can understand, muscle tension. So muscle tension, firstly, it's something that can be measured. Secondly, it's useful to measure it because, well, the idea is that when you're stressed or when you're anxious, you'll tighten up.
Yeah.
And especially when you have what I call resistance, is internal resistance, which is this attitude of not wanting to experience something. Yeah. Like when you go to the dentist and you see the big needle coming in, it's about to go into your jaw. It's natural that you tighten up almost as though you could brace yourself because you know it's going to be a little bit painful. Yeah. Now we do that quite naturally. We don't have to think about it. It's almost an instinct. Yeah. But the thing is, we do it all the time. We do it for not just for real physical threats, but for any kind of emotional threat, even very minor ones, even just thinking a thought, for example, having a memory of something embarrassing that happened to you, yeah, you'll want to push it away, and you'll probably your body will tighten up as a way of bracing against that memory, almost as though you could keep it out of your mind by doing that. Yeah, so you can measure muscle tension, and you can feed it back. One thing about muscle tension that makes it useful for biofeedback is that a lot of the changes are happening outside of awareness. You know, I often say it's a bit like the fridge in the kitchen. You know, you can be sitting in the kitchen, you think it's all quiet, and then the fridge switches off.
Yeah.
And then you know it was there all along.
Yeah.
Yeah. So muscle tension can be a little bit like that. It can be there without you realizing it.
Sure.
And then you can learn to let go, and then you sort of realize what it's like.
Yeah. I'm thinking again of my own mindfulness practice, that say that I've had a stressful situation or I'm feeling anxious about something. That's often when I find meditation particularly helpful, because if I'm doing a body scan or something, I'll notice tension in my jaw or a tightness in my chest or something like that. And that's when mindfulness does help. But you're saying that the biofeedback can act as an amplifier of that within the mindfulness practice.
Yes. Yeah, exactly so. And I think it's also, you've got to recognize it's a very dynamic process. So you might be doing your mindfulness practice, might be all going very well, you might be right in the zone, so to speak, and then a little distraction comes along and you start thinking about an argument that you had last week. And it might not be a big deal, but chances are it's going to manifest in your physiology. For example, you might tighten up, yeah, because you're getting a little bit angry.
Yeah,
you're recreating the emotional experience. And if you happen to be measuring muscle tension at that point, you can detect it, or the device can detect the change, maybe even before you do. So when you're practicing mindfulness, the hard part is noticing when you've gone off.
Sure.
Yeah. Sometimes it can be 10, 20 minutes. If you're like me, the mind can go off on one, and it can easily be 10 minutes before you realize, I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath. And you bring it back.
Yeah.
But if you can have a bit of help for doing that, then why not?
Yeah, no, that sounds very interesting. Okay, you mentioned muscle tension. That's one way that it can help. What other physiological phenomena are employed in biofeedback, in a similar fashion?
Right, okay. Well, I'll mention a couple of other ones which I use most commonly, and especially in regard to mindfulness practice, because they both relate to breathing. Now, mindfulness, a lot of the time, the focus of mindfulness practice is the breath. And I think the breath is a very good one to work with, because it's sort of a window on the mind, if you like. You know, the breath reflects the mind, and it's a sort of two-way thing. So if the mind becomes agitated, then the breath will change to somehow reflect that.
Yeah.
But conversely, if you can calm the breath, or if the breath can calm itself down, then it's going to have an impact on the mind. So getting, accessing calm breathing, if you like, is a useful sort of strategy for working with the mind, working with mindfulness practice. So what can you measure in the breath? I'm going to mention two parameters which are both very relevant. The first one is to do with the purpose of breathing is to bring oxygen into the body and into the cells that need it, and especially the brain cells. And at the same time, it's to remove carbon dioxide, which is essentially a waste product. Now, the breath can become dysregulated. I think a lot of people probably take breathing for granted, but it's quite commonly is dysregulated to some degree. And the most common form is overbreathing. A lot of people are overbreathing habitually. I think it ties in with stress. I think that stress leads us to sort of go into a state of sort of shallower breathing, but faster breathing, but overall increased ventilation. Now, the physiological effect of that is that it actually reduces oxygen delivery to brain cells. That's the nub of it. The key thing is that you reduce, paradoxically, by overbreathing, you reduce oxygen delivery to brain cells. So Overbreathing is not a good idea. It's not conducive to optimal mental functioning. So, for example, you wouldn't really want to overbreathe in mindfulness practice, or that's my view of it anyway. Yeah. So you can measure overbreathing. Yeah. And the way to do it is by measuring carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide is the key thing. So you can measure carbon dioxide in the out-breath, in the exhaled air. And we know from research that the exhaled carbon dioxide correlates to the level of carbon dioxide that's in the blood. And that's the key thing physiologically. Although carbon dioxide is a waste product, you want a good level in the blood, because too little is what causes the problems. It causes the blood supply to the brain to actually reduce. Yeah?
Yeah.
So you want plenty of carbon dioxide in the blood so that the blood can deliver the oxygen to the brain cells.
Okay.
Yeah? So yeah, you can measure carbon dioxide with a device called a capnometer. And it's the best way to detect overbreathing, and conversely, the opposite of overbreathing, which is, well, let's just call it gentle breathing. It can be slow breathing, but more than anything, gentle. And by doing that, you're learning to maximize oxygen delivery to the brain, and therefore you're going to feel more present,
mm-hmm.
more in control, if you like,
yeah.
more like you're driving the bus rather than the bus is driving you.
Okay. I've got that. And you mentioned another one as well, Glyn.
Yeah, that's right. The second one also relates to breathing, although perhaps a little bit more indirectly. It's called heart rate variability. So it's a measurement of heart rate, but you're not so much interested in the heart rate itself as the pattern of change in the heart rate. And there's a particular physiological effect called heart rate coherence, where the heart starts to change in sync with the breath, which is to say that it starts to speed up when you breathe in and it slows down again when you breathe out. Yeah, so it might change from the beginning of an in-breath, it might be say 50 beats per minute, and then you breathe in and it goes bum 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 bum. So it gets faster as the breath goes in, and maybe at the end of the breath it's maybe 70 beats per minute. And then you breathe out again and it slows back down again. So you can have these quite big swings in heart rate, maybe 20 beats per minute over the cycle of a breath.
Wow.
That's when you're in coherence, which is usually maximized in a particular state of breathing. So most of the time it's not going to be changing like that, because a typical sort of average breathing rate is too fast for that to happen. So this thing is called heart rate coherence, or at least sometimes it's called heart rate coherence. It's maximal at a particular rate of breathing, which is a slow rate of breathing, around about 6 breaths per minute, which is one breath every 10 seconds. So this state of heart rate coherence, it's known to have physiological benefits. For example, it's activating something called the parasympathetic nervous system, which is a branch of the automatic nervous system that's responsible for calming us down. So the parasympathetic nervous system calms down the body. At the same time, it can also activate the executive part of the mind. Yeah, so it can clarify your state of focus and awareness. So it's mind alert and body calm and gentle, which is so useful. It's what we want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So just to try and sort of encapsulate this, is the main idea behind biofeedback, is it that if you recreate the physiology of optimal states, you'll make it easier to access those states?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, I think that the connection is sort of loose and two-way. So if you, for example, if you're in a state of heart rate coherence, and if you're breathing optimally in the sense that you're not overbreathing, then you've got the physiological basis for calm, concentrated states of mind, which is not to say that you necessarily will be concentrated, you know, because your mind can still get distracted, even in that state. But in general, it's going to be easier to maintain your calm focus.
Yeah, and this connection with mindfulness practice, we've touched on this, could you maybe expand that a bit more, that how they work together in conjunction and how it benefits mindfulness practice?
Okay, so my view of mindfulness practice is that, well, it has a purpose. it's a training tool, if you like. It, you know, it derives mainly from the Buddhist tradition, and in Buddhism, mindfulness is a tool for transforming the mind, you could say, in most general terms. So transforming the mind meaning bringing into being certain qualities of mind, such as calmness, clarity, focus, freedom, positivity, and no doubt you could name a few more besides. And also at the same time, moving away from certain other qualities of mind, which are perhaps, you know, more negative in inverted commas, such as agitation, negativity, emotional negativity, distractibility, slothfulness, things like that. You want to move away from those. So the purpose of mindfulness is to transform the states of mind. And again, my overall idea is that as a strategy, if you can change the physiology, if you can guide your physiology from let's call it negative physiology to positive physiology in the sort of ways that I've been describing, then it just makes things easier. Now, I realize that there's a bit of a, it's a little bit controversial what I'm saying, because a lot of people have the view that when you practice mindfulness, you just watch the breath and you don't try to change the breath or anything like that. So I know from experience that a lot of seasoned mindfulness practitioners hear about biofeedback and they don't want anything to do with it because they think that it goes against the spirit of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually don't think it does, and I'll try and sort of defend my position. So I think that in mindfulness, it's not that the breath doesn't change or can't change. It's just that it doesn't change through willful effort. In fact, it probably will change if you're effective in transforming your state of mind. If you successfully sort of calm down, it's very likely that your breath will change, albeit more spontaneously, you know, without willed effort. All I'm saying is, well, why not just help that process on a little bit? Again, I'm not advocating using willpower to kind of force the physiology into a different state, but these mind-body skills that I'm talking about, they're more of the nature of allowing it to happen.
Yeah,
allowing the body to do it for you. And I think it helps if you know something kind of intellectually, if you like, what states of physiology will help, so that you can just give a little bit of guidance in helping, you know, just allowing your body to access those states.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me, actually, Glyn. And practically, how do you actually combine this machinery in a, you know, in a meditation sitting? How do you do it so that it helps you, but it's not intrusive?
Right, yes, exactly. It's a good point that you raised there. You don't want it to be intrusive. You know, if you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, you want your focus to be internal on your breath, not on some computer screen or some device. So you want the feedback to be non-intrusive, just as you say. Yeah. So there are ways that you can set it up to do that. So, for example, one of the things I do a lot in my own practice is use a form of audio feedback called threshold-based feedback. Now, first thing is to say is the feedback is audio, so I get a sound that tells me about the state of physiology rather than having to watch a graph. So that means I can do the practice with eyes closed. The idea of threshold-based feedback is that the feedback only comes in when some sort of threshold is crossed. So let me explain it with reference to the muscle tension, which we were talking about before. So let's say you get distracted and you get rather agitated because you're thinking about the row that you had last week. Yeah. So at that point, your physiology, your muscles tighten up. Yeah. And that tightening can be detected by the device, and the muscle tension, the level of muscle tension that it's measuring, can rise up above some threshold that you've set at the beginning of the practice. And when that happens, the software can just feed that back to you, for example, by ringing a bell. It can be as simple as that.
And a nice meditative Buddhist sounding gong, for example.
Yeah, something like that. Rather than say, you know, it brings to mind the Zen metaphor of the Zen master who whacks you on the back of the head with a stick. It can be a bit more gentle than that. But essentially, it's the same principle. It's just a little bit of help in guiding your focus.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, I'm just thinking of some other practical questions that people might ask. You know, is it how easy is it to get hold of the equipment, and to what degree do you need guidance with it?
Right, okay. So there are various different biofeedback devices available. The most easy to come by is the heart rate variability biofeedback. So you can get quite a few cheap devices that measure heart rate, for example, by clipping it onto the earlobe or onto a finger. And they can feed back HRV, heart rate variability, so you can access this heart rate coherence. And most of them as well, they'll also give you some form of audio feedback. So for example, the best known HRV device is a device that comes from a group called the HeartMath Institute, they're mainly responsible for the popularity of HRV biofeedback. And they've got a device, it's called M-Wave. And you can get it, you can get two versions, you can get a standalone version, or you can get a version that plugs into, connects to a computer like a laptop or something like that, and you can run it through software. So they're of the order of £100-£200 at most, something like that. And you can get cheaper sort of competitors to that device. Other parameters are harder to come by. So the capnometry one that I mentioned, I use it a lot in my, not in my personal meditation practice, because admittedly, the thing about capnometry is once you've learned to do it, then you can do it, and you don't actually need the biofeedback. But I do use capnometry to measure overbreathing in my professional practice with clients who are anxious and stressed, because they are overbreathers. And I do have devices available to rent out. So I rent out capnometers to take home. They are more expensive.
And when you personally are having a meditation session, do you just tend to use one parameter, or do you have two or three? Do you ever use them in combination with each other?
I tend to use them one at a time. Again, this is in my own practice. I tend to use them one at a time, but I do sort of switch between them. So for example, I might use muscle tension for a couple of weeks, and then I might switch and go to heart rate variability. Yeah. So I tend to use one at a time just for simplicity. I think it's reasonable to use more than one.
Yeah.
But I also think once you've got a certain amount of experience with it, then you don't need to.
Yeah. I think also it's quite pragmatic to keep your meditation or mindfulness practice fresh as well. You know, sometimes I'll do a body scan one day and then another. I have certain general patterns. I generally tend to focus on the breath, but I might focus on sounds one day or something, and I find that helpful. So that right. Seems to tie in with that as well.
Yes, I think so. Yeah. So for example, when I'm using HRV biofeedback in my meditation practice, I do very much focus on the breath. But if I'm using muscle tension biofeedback, then I generally make it a much more general body awareness, depending on where I'm measuring the muscle tension from. So one of the things that I commonly do is measure muscle tension from the forehead, which picks up any tension in the head. So if your jaw is tight or if your eyes are tight, then it will pick that up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that often can become quite a useful place to focus, because head tension and especially facial tension does reflect the sort of the mental process and thinking process. If you're getting into a sort of distraction whereby you're running an inner dialogue about something, so if you're talking to yourself, then it will typically manifest as muscle tension that you can measure in the face, and you can measure that and detect it and pick it up and have it sort of warn you that that's going on. So yeah, it does. The type of practice that you're doing, you know, fits with different biofeedback parameters.
Great. Okay, and then there's biofeedback, and then there's also neurofeedback. What's the difference there?
Okay, neurofeedback is just a form of biofeedback. So biofeedback is the more general term. In neurofeedback, what you're doing is you're measuring activity that comes directly from the brain, as opposed to biofeedback, you know, the other forms of biofeedback, sometimes called peripheral biofeedback, where you're measuring something else like heart rate, which is, of course, controlled by the brain or influenced by the brain, but it's not directly the brain. So typically, with neurofeedback, you're measuring EEG or brain waves. And this is becoming more and more popular, that there are even consumer neurofeedback devices that you can get that are based on measuring EEG that are even quite simple to use. And yeah, although I wouldn't say that I use them myself, certainly other people are out there using them in the context of meditation practice. So there's definitely an overlap.
Okay. Okay then, Glyn, what's your understanding of the middle way, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Okay, well, the first idea that comes to my mind is balance. So I think this is a very, very much a key thing. If we talk about, say, going back to mindfulness practice, mindfulness is a way of applying the mind. I think there's this, yeah, I think with mindfulness, it's quite easy to kind of misinterpret the instructions sometimes. So with mindfulness, very much the idea is that, the traditional teaching is that don't be too bothered if you get distracted. You know, it's almost like it doesn't really matter if you get distracted, as long as you keep coming back to the focus again and again. Yeah. But I think you can sort of take that too far. I think you can lose sight of the fact that mindfulness has a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah?
It is about developing certain qualities. There's a sort of paradoxical mindset in mindfulness, which is that you're still trying to do something,
yeah,
but it's almost like it doesn't really matter whether you actually do it or not. But moreover, I think you are applying your mind. It's not the same as sitting there daydreaming. If you're sitting there daydreaming for half an hour or whatever, that's not meditation. So I think that mindfulness is very much a kind of balanced control, if you like. I think we could even use that word. I think that you don't want to be over controlling, which is being willful. You don't want to be overly willful. And I think that's what, you know, people tend to know about. That's, you know, an obvious aspect of mindfulness teaching. But equally on the other side, you don't want to be under controlling either. You don't, like I say, you don't want to be just kind of sitting there daydreaming. So I think that aspect of mindfulness as a middle way of control, a middle way of attention. You know, it's a certain kind of attention. It's not over-focused. It's not under-focused. Yeah, it's a balanced focus.
Okay, now I think that's a really good example, Glyn. Okay, well, my last question, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Okay, well, they can find my website, which is www.york-biofeedback.co.uk. Another thing that perhaps might be worth mentioning is also get it for Nook, which is another ebook reader. If you don't have a Kindle, you can still read it, but you'd need the free Amazon software for reading ebooks.
Okay, that's great. Well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Glyn. I've certainly got a lot better idea of what biofeedback is about now, and hopefully, I imagine our listeners will have too.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.